Don't call it a comeback. Well, actually, it kind of can. Just don't call it NAFTA. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 1st of October. Good, as always, to have you with us. And we start today with NAFTA, or rather the deal to replace it. Last night, after about a year of trade negotiations, the U.S., Mexico, and Canada finally reached the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA.
In this, we will have a result of much more happening right here in the United States. It means, more than anything else, far more American jobs, and these are high-quality jobs. There are also strong provisions to enforce what's called the rules of origin requirements. This will incentivize billions of dollars in new purchases of U.S.-made automobiles.
All right, so you heard the president. Let's unpack this agreement a little bit. New name and all, we've got Marketplace's Scott Tong. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, manufacturing powerhouse. That's the president's phrase. That's what he said this new trade deal is going to create in the U.S. So let's talk jobs first. Is this really going to create new jobs?
At the very least, it's unclear. So let's take automobiles. Auto jobs are at the center of the rhetoric.
The oracle of everything. Come on.
and where a lot of the jobs involved are. So if you assemble, let's say you assemble cars or trucks to sell here in North America, you might be Toyota or GM or BMW. Right now, 62.5% of your content has to be from Mexico or the U.S. or Canada. That's to avoid tariffs under the current deal, or else it's taxed. So this new deal, right, NAFTA 2.0, whatever, boosts that up to 75%. So the idea is, well, let's make North American cars even more North American. Now, here's the problem. The problem is the sanction, right, the or else, right? You have to do these chores or else I take away your phone, right? We say that in my house. Well, the or else here is a tariff of 2.5%. So if you make cars in Mexico, where it's cheaper and how a lot of automakers dug their way out of the Great Recession, you might say, well, you know, instead of messing with my supply chain and finding parts in Indiana where it's expensive and it's bureaucratic, I'm just going to eat the tariff of 2.5%. And since I'm non-compliant anyway, I might source more of my parts from low-cost places like China. I'll just get around it. So that makes for more jobs in China and more jobs in Mexico. Or let's say, okay, I follow the rules. I have more U.S. content from more U.S. suppliers. That's probably going to be more expensive. So my costs go up, my prices go up, I can't compete. I might sell fewer cars and sales go down and I lay off people. So several ways this could backfire as far as jobs.
When we talk about jobs, one of the big focuses here has been high-wage jobs. And there is a provision in this to create and protect auto jobs that pay at least $16 an hour. So how does that fit into this?
So this deal says a large percent of each vehicle has to be made by workers who make $16 an hour or more. So what do companies do when wages get pushed up? Well, sometimes, yes, they hire more workers who make more money. Sometimes they say, you know what? It's time for me to invest in more software and more robots, right? More automation to replace people. And as the cost of worker goes up and the cost of automation goes down, there's no guarantee that employers are going to respond the way we think they might.
Well, so looking a little more broadly, this doesn't take off all of the tariffs against Canada and Mexico. You know, they're not all off the table. It's a little confusing what's here and what's not.
Yeah. So right now we do have tariffs on foreign steel and aluminum. Those are announced. Those are in place. And the justification is because of national security. So Canadian steel, Mexican steel is still subject to that. And it's complicated, but there could be similar tariffs on automobiles coming as well. We're waiting for the Trump administration on that. That's on a separate track. But for right now, steel tariffs are still in place in North America.
And finally, since we're sitting here in D.C. today, what are the chances this all gets approved by Congress?
Well, good luck, Lizzie, predicting in this town. A vote on this would come next year after the midterms when there's a good chance the Democrats could very well take the House, right? And historically, Democrats have been more anti-trade deal. Now, this deal is more complex and might have pieces that Democrats could support, but whether they're going to give the president a victory, that's a different question.
Marketplace's Scott Tong, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
NAFTA has had a long history. Question for you, who was the first president to talk about that idea? We've got a video with the answer. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the little tab that says Mentioned on Air. Now, we're going to stay with trade and the USMCA, The White House says the agreement is a, quote, win for American farmers, ranchers, and agribusiness. Well, someone in that category is Patrick Smith. He runs Loftus Ranches in Yakima, Washington. They grow apples and also hops, you know, for beer. Washington State is a big producer of both those crops, and Mexico and Canada are big buyers. We've had Patrick on before to talk about all this, so welcome back.
Thanks, Lizzie. Glad to be here.
All right. So based on what you know so far, how does this deal look?
So far, I think there's a lot for farmers to be excited about in this deal. Farmers, of course, deal with a lot of uncertainty already. And so taking away some of the uncertainty regarding a couple of our most important trading partners is welcome news for most of us.
Do you think the people around you are, you know, exhaling a little bit today?
I do. I think, you know, Mexico is a very important market for U.S. agriculture in general, and in our region, especially fresh apples. And with the back and forth on trade over the last few months, Mexico had established a tariff on U.S. apples. And so now apples in this deal have no tariff applied to them. And I think for us up here in the central part of Washington State, that's a big relief.
So last time you were on the show, you talked about apple exports slowing down. Do you think that maybe this deal, you know, speeds up apple exports this year, or has that ship already sailed?
I think we're hoping that export levels will return to where they were earlier this year. You know, we were having really good movement into Mexico in the first 4 or 5 months of the year. And then this summer, after the tariffs were imposed, that movement slowed down significantly. And so hopefully we do see a return to those levels from the first half of the year. And we're hopeful that we'll get there in short order.
When you look at this, are you sitting there thinking this is just NAFTA again? Or are there differences that you see? I mean, how does this play out for you on the ground? Is it the same thing with a different name?
It does kind of look like that from our end right now. I'm sure that there are some differences for maybe some other industries. But for us and our businesses, both hops and apples, this looks a lot like what we've had the last few years. And that's good.
You know, are you still concerned about trade in the rest of the world, trade with Asia, for example? Or has this given you enough breathing room that you get to sleep easy tonight?
I think we're still hopeful that this is one step toward maybe normalizing trading relationships with Asia, with Europe. Mexico and Canada, of course, are two very, very important markets for us. But we're moving apples and hops around the world and would like to see you know, more of these types of deals come, similar to the Trans-Pacific Partnership that we've pulled out of. But more of these types of deals would be very welcomed by most of us in our industries.
I got to ask you, the first time you were on this show in 2016, you were worried about having enough workers to do the work you do and harvest your crops. Is that still an issue for you?
Yeah, it absolutely is. Labor in our part of the country up here, farm labor is still somewhat scarce. For us and many other employers in this region, we're extensively using the H-2A guest worker visa program to help meet our labor needs. And there are some bills that are, you know, somewhere in Congress right now that would make some positive changes to the program, but a lot of those efforts have kind of stalled out over the last few months. And so we're hopeful that we will see changes to the program as soon as Congress is ready to act on it.
Patrick Smith from Loftus Ranches, good to have you back on the show.
Great. Thanks, Lizzie.
If you have questions about this revised trade relationship between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, or any trade questions in general, we'd love to answer them. Leave us a note at marketplace.org, and there you can read more about economic winners from today's announcement. On Wall Street today, the markets love that trade news. Details when we do the numbers. We have the latest chapter today in the saga that is Elon Musk and his relationship with Tesla, the company he co-founded. He's giving up a little bit of control over it. That's the upshot of a settlement the electric car maker reached over the weekend with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The agreement settles fraud charges the SEC brought against Musk after he tweeted in August that he had, quote, funding secured for a deal to take Tesla private. Except he didn't. The agreement with the SEC is aimed at reining him in. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Basically, the SEC settlement is all about keeping watch over Elon Musk and his tweets.
As his own worst enemy, that's what's had to happen. That's what the SEC has had to do.
Rebecca Lindland is an executive analyst at Kelley Blue Book.
The company needs to control Elon Musk better, and Elon Musk needs to be a better steward of the company that he started.
So the SEC is strengthening Tesla's board. Musk will step down as board chairman, although he'll still be CEO. Tesla has to appoint two new independent directors to the board. Jill Fish is a law professor at the University of Pennsylvania. She says some lucky person will be pre-approving Musk's tweets and establishing
how those tweets are going to be set up, what kind of information they can contain. It's an overall policy.
But Fish says Musk may be tough to rein in. Early this morning, Musk tweeted a video from the hip-hop band Naughty by Nature with a winking emoji that could be a reference to the SEC settlement. If he and Tesla don't comply with the settlement, the SEC will step back in. Carl Tobias teaches law at the University of Richmond.
They could go back and say you're in violation of the agreement. They could open another suit to guarantee that he would comply with the settlement agreement.
Or maybe fine Tesla again. Tesla and Musk both already face $40 million in penalties. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Elon Musk may have given Tesla's board some headaches, but now we're going to look at the composition of boards themselves. California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill into law Sunday requiring that publicly held corporations headquartered in the state include women on their boards. This law is the first of its kind in the U.S., and we've got Jenna McGregor to talk about it. She covers corporate governance for The Washington Post. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Give me a rundown of what this law is and who will be affected by it.
So California Governor Jerry Brown just signed into law a bill that lawmakers there have been trying to get through for a long time to actually require companies that have their principal offices in California to have what will start with at least one female director on their board.
Do most boards include women already? I mean, how unusual is it either to have women on boards or not have women on boards?
Particularly large companies, most have a woman on the board, large publicly traded companies. But their numbers show that about 25% of companies headquartered, publicly traded headquartered companies in California do not have any women. And so they're trying to fix that issue through having a mandate of sorts. It will grow over time. Over the next couple of years, they're going to add to it where it's not just one that you're required to have, but depending on the size of the board, they want you to have one, two, or three. And really, most companies are probably going to need to have three that are headquartered in California.
What happens if your company's headquartered in California, but say you're incorporated somewhere else? Does this still apply?
That's the big question here. So they have put through this bill, but there are both business groups in California, some corporate governance experts, including former members of the SEC, have said, you know what, this may not fly. This may face some legal challenges because many, many, many companies are actually incorporated in Delaware, which is a state that has a little friendlier business environment, and that the law has said those are the legal circumstances under which a company has to follow. And so it may not apply. So this law may face some legal challenges from companies who say this shouldn't matter.
When Governor Jerry Brown was talking about this, he referred to recent events in Washington. And you wrote about the Brett Kavanaugh hearings in the Senate Judiciary Committee and sort of the appearance of having a female prosecutor there in the room. How much of this is about appearance and how much is about change in corporate governance?
Well, I have seen the same question of whether he is trying to make a statement, particularly this week, although this was the deadline, end of September, for deciding to sign it into law. So what was this a way of making a statement of what the country has been engaged in a major national conversation about?
Yeah.
The issue of whether having more women on the board has any impact is a good question. There is a lot of research that shows it does have a good impact, that it leads to either higher returns or better decision-making or better priced mergers. Yet the question is, how do you do it? Do you actually require them to do it? Do you have incentives for them to do it? Do you do it through kind of public shaming? And so what is the best approach to getting more diversity on the board or getting more diversity in a room full of any decision makers?
Jenna McGregor from The Washington Post, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, landlords beware.
And then that's when we started getting information, and that's when we started the strike.
Renters are heading to the picket lines. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 192 points, nearly 0.75% to close at 26,651. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.1% to finish at 8037. And the S&P 500 found 10 points, about 0.3% to end at 2924. We talked about that new trade deal with Canada that, among other things, would give U.S. dairy farmers greater access to the Canadian market. U.S. dairy giant Dean Foods fortified nearly 1%. And U.S.-based Lifeway Foods, which makes dairy-based kefir products, drank up more than 10%. And we talked about that Tesla up-and-down ride, powered in part by the tweeting habits of its founder, Elon Musk. Today, with all that news we mentioned about Musk's settlement with the SEC that allows him to stay on as CEO, Tesla charged up more than 17%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.08%. You're listening to Marketplace.
As a nonprofit news organization, Marketplace is able to do what we do every day thanks to funding from public radio stations, foundations, corporate underwriters, and listeners like you. Thank you to all the Marketplace investors who've contributed over the past year for helping keep public service journalism strong. We appreciate your support.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. General Electric told investors today that its CEO, John Flannery, was out after only about a year on the job. The company also said, yeah, it's not going to make that profit forecast this year. Frankly, things are not great at GE, which raises the question, what is the role of an industrial conglomerate in today's economy anyway? Marketplace's Andy Euler has that one.
General Electric is a far cry from the company Thomas Edison co-founded back in the 1890s. Today, GE makes aircraft engines, equipment for oil and gas production, and medical imaging, among many other things. Perhaps too many things, says John Joseph. He teaches management at the University of California, Irvine.
It is a time when the industrial conglomerate is gone.
He says competition and market conditions change very quickly today, so companies have to react on a dime.
Typically, big industrial conglomerates, one does not think of being nimble.
GE's been trying to focus. The firm sold its insurance outfit years ago and reined in its lending business after heavy losses during the financial crisis. Lawrence White, economics professor at NYU, says these focus trends tend to ebb and flow. While GE is trying to get smaller,
Amazon is going in the opposite direction.
He's right. Amazon's got grocery stores, web services, and is talking about getting into healthcare. All a far cry from its original idea of just mailing you books. But John Joseph at UC Irvine argues that Amazon is different because it's leveraging a central platform. So even though it appears to be spread out, it's more focused than it seems.
Amazon is attempting to bring, you know, those that are selling stuff together with those that are buying stuff. GE is a different beast.
And one that has to move much more quickly than it has in the past. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
your mind back in time a little bit to the growing cities of the early 20th century. Back then, rent strikes were a common tool to protest conditions in crowded tenements. Now, it seems the practice is making a comeback in Los Angeles and other cities with tight housing markets. KPCC's Matt Tinoco reports.
It was bad news when Joanna Ochoa's landlord told her back in January that her monthly rent would go up by $100. But the alarm bells really started going off in April when the rent went up again, another $250.
Everybody started thinking, whoa, this is too much.
The same thing happened to virtually all the residents of the Burlington Apartments, a 200-unit complex just west of downtown Los Angeles, built in the late 1980s. LA has rent control laws, but the Burlington Apartments are too new to qualify.
That's when us tenants started realizing, no, something's wrong. This is not right. And then that's when we started getting information, and that's when we started a strike.
A rent strike. To pressure their landlord into negotiating rental rates and addressing neglected upkeep, tenants in about 80 units just stopped paying rent. On a recent summer evening, about 200 residents and activists marched through their neighborhood in protest.
You have tenants who have been living in deplorable conditions for many, many, many years. And now the landlord is raising their rents, and it's caused a crisis with the tenants.
Trinidad Ruiz is a volunteer with the Los Angeles Tenants Union. The group teaches renters their legal rights, like how in California they can withhold rent if a landlord fails to properly maintain a building.
All they have are their rent checks, and so they use that because really they don't have any other recourse.
In a written statement, landlord representative FML Management said that rents have been raised to cover operating costs. LA's not the only city to see rent strikes. A check of the web turned up similar actions this year in San Francisco, New York, D.C., Houston, and Portland. These are all places that you would expect them to be if you're Michelle Wild Anderson, a Stanford professor who studies urban poverty.
These are places that are we could think of as job rich and housing poor.
That is, metro areas that have added many more new jobs and residents than housing units. The classic recipe for high rents.
The rent levels and the housing conditions have gotten so far out of whack with each other that people basically start yelling from their windows that they're not going to take it anymore.
Burlington resident Ray Estrada gave me a tour of the complex. Rotting walls are soft to the touch. Recently painted surfaces are cracked, showing mold underneath. In the parking garage, residue from sewage overflows clings to the walls and the pipes. Then he took me up to the roof.
There's certain areas here that are very...
I interrupted him before he could say soft.
I can feel it. It's walking. I'm on the beach or something here.
A lot of the roof squelched when I walked on it. It's one of the reasons that Estrada worries a lot about the structural integrity of the building.
We're not complaining or we just want to get free rent. No, we want to pay our rent, but we want to live in a safe environment.
In its statement, FML Management says that all maintenance requests are handled immediately. But rent strikes don't come without risks. In the case of the Burlington Apartments, the landlord moved to evict the striking tenants. They dropped most of those suits in September after tenants agreed to pay what they could in back rent. But at least three tenants were evicted. In Los Angeles, I'm Matt Tinoco for Marketplace.
This final note before we go today, choose your own adventure, dystopian style. According to Bloomberg, Netflix is developing a series of special TV show episodes where viewers will get to choose how the storyline of a show develops. One of those shows will reportedly be Black Mirror, which honestly sounds terrifying. Also, I read all those Choose Your Own Adventure books as a kid, and I loved them. But you know what? Reacting to situations and making a series of decisions where your character does something and then other characters also do things, that's called real life, and I don't know if I want to watch that. All right, that's it. We gotta go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 192 points, nearly 0.75%. The NASDAQ lost 9 points, 0.1%. And the S&P 500 found 10 points, about 0.33%. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Phoebe Unterman. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl, and we'll see you all tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.